So in order to set the context for smoothing theory, I want to start with the basics of manifolds and some of the history of manifold theory. So to be sure that we're all on the same page with this, how would we define a manifold? Well, basically a manifold is something that's supposed to look locally like Euclidean space. So first of all, make the definition that a topological N-manifold is a reasonably nice topological space, let's say a Hausdorff space with a countable basis. Or if we said metrizable, we'd end up in the same place, such that, well, let's say that is locally Euclidean, locally, in fact, Rn. What does that mean? Well, we have the picture presumably most of us have seen before, that at any given point there should be a neighborhood and a homeomorphism from some open set in Rn into the manifold. And so that gives it a nice definition sort of in the topological world, sort of most naive definition that a topologist would think of pretty quickly. But there are several problems with this definition. One is that if you try to actually prove things about topological manifolds, it turns out to be extremely difficult. And the other is that, if you think about who uses manifolds in practice, well, you've got differential geometers and global analysts and physicists and people like that, and they all want to be able to do calculus on their manifolds. And how do you take the derivative on something like that? Well, there's really no way to do that without some additional structure. And so basically what we do is make this into something we call a smooth manifold by introducing a smooth structure. And let's just say we get a smooth structure by covering this topological space X, let's say, by charts that are related by diffeomorphisms on the overlaps. So what does that mean? Well, we got one so-called chart here, and then we have another chart over here, let's say. So we want to cover the whole manifold by open sets that look like pieces of Euclidean space. And then we have this little piece in the middle that whose pre-image lives over here and over here. And now it doesn't make any sense to ask whether these maps are smooth because we don't know what that means. But these two things are both open subsets of Euclidean space, and we have a homeomorphism going from one to the other just by composing these things. And it certainly does make sense to require that to be a diffeomorphism, a diffeomorphism just being a homeomorphism that's smooth and has a smooth inverse. So the composite map here has the property that F is smooth and also F inverse is smooth. So that's what I mean by a diffeomorphism. And now once we've got such a structure on our manifold, we know what smooth functions are, because if I have, well, we define a function to be smooth if its pre-image under each of these functions is a smooth function. And so then if our function looks smooth when we pull it back to here, then when we look on this overlap region, if I change my mind and I want to look at it over here instead, then we're changing by precomposing with a diffeomorphism, and it doesn't change whether the thing looks smooth or not. So this is precisely the structure we need in order to talk about smooth maps between smooth manifolds, and then one can set up the whole machinery of calculus. And that's what a smooth structure on a manifold is. And now when should we think of two of these so-called smooth manifolds as being the same? Well, we think of two smooth manifolds as the same if they're diffeomorphic. Again, meaning there's a homeomorphism between them that's smooth and has a smooth inverse. So if we precompose it with this homeomorphism, that doesn't change the notion of smoothness. So that's we should think of two smooth manifolds as being essentially the same if they're diffeomorphic. Well, what if we have two different smooth structures on the same manifold? Well, then it's a little more subtle. And we want to think of the underlying topological manifold as being fixed, and then there's some sort of annoying things that could change the setup I've got here. Like, one thing we could do is just add another chart to our collection of charts so that everything is smooth, and we don't want that to really represent a new smooth structure. And the other thing we could do is just take this thing and sort of crinkle it a little by some homeomorphism, and that again will change the smooth structure, but not in a very interesting way. So what we can do is call two smooth structures on a fixed topological manifold X isotopic if there exists a diffeomorphism from one to the other, and that diffeomorphism then is implicitly a self-homeomorphism of the underlying topological manifold X. And we could ask that homeomorphism to be isotopic to the identity map, meaning homotopic through homeomorphisms. So if there's a diffeomorphism that is homotopic to the identity on X through homeomorphisms. So that's exactly what I mean by crinkling. If I take this one manifold and I kind of crinkle it up, I've got this one, I start with the identity and I've got this one parameter family of homeomorphisms, and then the smooth structure I get at the end is clearly isotopic to the original one. And we want to think of smooth structures as being essentially the same if they're isotopic in that sense. All right, so now that we know what objects we're working with, what are the basic questions we'd like to ask? Well, we would like to, and ultimately, whenever you have new mathematical objects like this, what you would hope for is a classification. We'd want to know exactly what n manifolds we have in a given dimension. Well, that's, of course, way too ambitious, unless we're in low dimensions like 2 or below. So, certainly in dimensions 4 and above, that's a way too ambitious question to ask, but we can still ask questions of that nature. We could ask for a given constraint on the algebraic topology. Do manifolds exist satisfying that constraint? And we could ask that in either the topological world or the smooth world. And if so, how many? So is just a simple sort of question one could address this way. We could ask, what is the classification of simply connected manifolds? And it turns out that in dimensions n equal to 5 and 6, simply connected manifolds are classified completely, both in the topological world and the smooth world. So that goes back to the middle of the mid to late 20th century. So there's an example of a problem one can actually answer. We've fixed this algebra topological condition of simple connectivity, and then one can say exactly what homeomorphism types of topological manifolds or diffeomorphism types of smooth manifolds there are. So in order to answer questions like this, one needs big, powerful tools. And in fact, in the basically in the, say, 50s and 60s, roughly, or when the big, powerful tools of high-dimensional topology were developed, there are two main tools. There's something called surgery theory, which addresses the existence question. The basic idea is you take a very simple manifold, like the n-sphere, for example, and you want to get a particular, you want to get manifolds with particular algebraic topology, and you do that by taking your one simple manifold and cutting and pasting things and making the topology more complicated until hopefully it matches the description you want in the end. So that's how surgery theory works. It tells you whether or not manifolds with particular topological constraints exist. And then there's something called, well, in general, the Escobordism theorem. Escobordism. Which really addresses uniqueness. If you have two manifolds satisfying the same algebra topological data, you can ask if they're, well, homeomorphic or diffeomorphic, depending on what category you're in, and the Escobordism theorem gives you a way to show that they are essentially the same manifold. And when you can't show they're the same, putting these things together, you generally end up with a classification if you've formulated the problem correctly. So, again, this was done in the mid to late 20th century, 50s and 60s, basically. And it was done, actually, in both categories. Remember I said the topological category is very difficult, so historically the way this worked is the smooth case was done first. In the smooth case, you have all this powerful stuff like transversality theory to work with, and that really helps you out. That's what we need to prove both of these theorems. And then once all that machinery is established, once you really understand the smooth category, you can start taking all your answers and trying to push them into the topological category. And with sufficient work, we get the topological version. So in both categories, ultimately, we have these powerful tools for answering existence and uniqueness questions. And so now, by now, there's a lot that's understood about high-dimensional manifolds. There's this very powerful stuff for answering whatever questions you might have about them. And one important observation here is that this stuff only works in dimensions greater than or equal to 5. So somehow, in order to prove these theorems, you need enough room to work. And if you have at least 5 dimensions, then you've got enough room to work. You somehow, what it comes down to is you want generic surfaces to be disjoint from each other, or generically mapped surfaces to be embedded, 2-dimensional surfaces. And as long as you have at least 5 dimensions, you can do that, and that's enough to make all this machinery work. But if you're in dimension 4, for example, then you try to separate these surfaces and you can't do it, and then you're really stuck. So back in the 50s and 60s and 70s, there was this beautiful machinery developing for high dimensions, and nothing really worked in dimension 4. There was very little known in dimension 4 up until the 80s at least. But once we've got these two parallel theories in existence, then the natural question to ask is, how do these things fit together? So if we have a fixed topological manifold, you could ask, does it admit essentially a unique smooth structure, for example? And the naive answer seems like it ought to be yes. In fact, there's a theorem due to Moise, back in the 50s, I believe, that says that every 3-manifold, a topological 3-manifold, I should say, has a unique isotopy class of smooth structures. And, of course, dimensions less than 3 are very classical. That's more like the 19th century. So when Moise proved this, basically all manifolds up to dimension 3 were essentially uniquely smoothable, and so it seemed like a good conjecture would have been would have been that every manifold is uniquely smoothable. It just takes more and more work as you get up into higher dimensions. I wasn't around back then, or well, I was born in 57, so I was just barely around in the 50s. But the natural thing to conjecture here is that in fact this is true in all dimensions, but it's just too hard to prove without a lot more work. But then in the late 50s, there was this surprising theorem of Milner that says that in fact the seven sphere has more than one smoothing on it. In fact, S7 admits 28 different smoothings, either up to isotopy or orientation preserving diffeomorphism. Some of these look the same as others reflected in a mirror, but other than that, they're all distinct. So we get 28 different smooth 7 manifolds, all of which are homeomorphic to the 7 sphere, but no two of which are diffeomorphic. And so that was a rather surprising development then. You can kind of see in hindsight what these all look like. Somehow we take the 7 sphere and we split it up as a union of two 7-dimensional disks. If we just glue sort of by the identity on this equatorial 6 sphere, then we get the 7 sphere. But it turns out that the 6 sphere has some really strange self-diffeomorphisms. And if you glue by these strange self-diffeomorphisms, then you get so-called twisted spheres, which are not diffeomorphic to the standard sphere. And yet you can see that when we glue with a weird twist, you get something that's still homeomorphic to a sphere, because we can think of D7 as being topologically just the 6 sphere cross I modulo S6 cross 1. Right, so we think of just a cylinder, and then we pinch off one end, and topologically that's just a disk. So whatever the strange diffeomorphism on the 6 sphere is, it extends over S6 cross I, and then it extends over the 7 sphere. So topologically, we're not doing anything interesting, but in the smooth category, we're getting these strange objects. So now that we've got these exotic 7 spheres, we should, we should ask what other games we can play with this same machinery. And the next observation is that we get, before I mention that, there's one other observation I should point out here. Namely, I showed you how you see that these are all homeomorphic. How do we know they're not diffeomorphic? Well, it turns out that one of these exotic 7 spheres, any one of these exotic 7 spheres can be made to bound some strange 8 manifold, X8, let's say. And, well, since the 7 sphere is just S6 cross I modulo the boundary, well, we can just take that cone and use that to cap off this compact manifold. And so this is a perfectly good topological manifold, because topologically this is just a ball. But it's, it turns out you can set this up in such a way that the resulting 8 manifold has impossible properties for a smooth manifold. Its signature is wrong. 8 manifolds have signature divisible by something, and this won't have signature divisible by that. So in fact, that shows two things. On the one hand, it shows that this 7 sphere has to be exotic, because if it were standard, we could stick on a smooth ball and get an impossible object. And on the other hand, it shows that this 8 manifold is unsmoothable. Well, more precisely, it shows there exists an unsmoothable 8 manifold. I've just constructed it for you. And so we see some manifolds have more than one smooth structure, and some manifolds don't have any smooth structure at all. You try to iron this thing out, and another corner is going to pop up somewhere. So if we lived in 8 dimensions, you could play practical jokes with this thing, I suppose. But anyway, All right, so that gives us some examples, both of the failure of existence and uniqueness for smooth structures. Well, once we've got these examples, how do we get some other examples? Well, let's look at, first of all, suppose I have any 7-manifold. What I can do is form the connected sum with one of these exotic spheres. What is a connected sum? Well, we just punch a hole in this, and we punch a hole in this, and we sort of glue them together along the boundary. Well, since sigma has this description in the far board, another way of looking at it is we remove a disk and we glue the disk in with one of these funny twists, but I want to define connected sum in more generality. And, well, what we expect is that, since these funny twists give us exotic spheres, they probably should give us other exotic manifolds as well. And in fact, that's what happens. You get a lot of exotic 7-manifolds with this trick. And now you could ask, what about higher dimensions? And one game we can play is take the product with some other manifold y of dimension n, let's say. And then we get an unsmoothable eight plus n manifold. Well, the basic idea, well, what does that look like? Well, we take x and we cross it with something, and instead of having this bad point where there's a crinkle, we're going to have a bad copy of y in there, where we see a crinkle all along the y, all along y in the normal directions. And so what that comes down to, well, what that means somehow is that, this is unsmoothable along a copy of this n-manifold y. And so, really, we could think of this copy of y as representing an n-dimensional homology class in our manifold z n plus 8, let's say. And, since there are 28 possible spheres we could glue in here, what's going to happen is that we expect to see somehow 28 different 7-manifolds, and then we're going to see somehow 28 things, I'm kind of playing two games at once here, but somehow we've got this problem with 28 possible ways of crinkling this thing, and that's somehow going to give us 28 possible ways of crinkling along an n-dimensional submanifold. And really, I want to use Poincaré duality here and think of this as an eight-dimensional cohomology class with coefficients in Z28. So this n-dimensional submanifold corresponds to somehow a codimension n cohomology class, and really somehow this some element of this eight-dimensional cohomology with Z28 coefficients is measuring the failure of smoothability of this manifold Z. So we get some class and cohomology class inside of here that can be calculated, and that measures this obstruction to existence of a smooth structure. And similarly, as far as existence goes, this is the existence part. As far as uniqueness goes, well, in dimension 7, we expect to see 28 different smooth structures. We cross with the manifold Y, and now again, we somehow expect to see 28 different smooth structures, but they're associated not to a neighborhood of a point now, but to a neighborhood of this copy of Y. And so now the point has codimension 7, so for uniqueness, we're going to get H upper 7 of Z whatever with coefficients in Z28. So somehow these exotic 7 spheres, well, there are 28 of them, and they actually form a group under connected sum, and the group is Z28. And somehow that Z28 is telling us how to classify, it's part of the classification of high-dimensional manifolds, that the existence question is about the vanishing of a certain cohomology class here with coefficients in the group of homology, of homotopy 7 spheres. And then we see the uniqueness question. If the manifold is smoothable, then somehow associated to any given homology class, we have 28 possible smooth structures. So this is the basic idea of what's going on here. And, well, that isn't the end of the story. In fact, in most dimensions, n greater than or equal to 7, we get exotic n-spheres forming a group under connected sum. It'll be, in fact, a finite abelian group. And so that's going to contribute to other smoothing obstructions. Basically, in any dimension, we're going to have some group of homotopy spheres, and then we look at the corresponding, let's see, this I guess would be the n plus 1 dimensional cohomology with coefficients in the group of exotic n spheres, and then that would be about existence, and then for uniqueness, we've got something one dimension lower. So there's this whole obstruction theory, as it's called, for dealing with existence and uniqueness of smooth structures and manifolds. But then basically, that's almost the whole story. I guess there's one other thing I should mention, namely, there is one other existence obstruction that we get is, I'll call it KS, that's the Kirby-Siebenmann obstruction. Again, that's an existence obstruction in H upper 4 of X with Z2 coefficients, and there's a uniqueness obstruction in which is basically H upper 3 of X with Z2 coefficients. Where do they come from? Well, if you look at what happens in higher dimensions, the prediction would be that the group of homotopy 3 spheres is Z2, and that should contribute. Well, Perelman tells us now that there aren't any homotopy 3 spheres except the standard one, so somehow that's not quite the right answer. So the problem is we're in too low a dimension and things aren't working quite the way they do in higher dimensions. But still, it's a similar story in some sense, even though there aren't any exotic in any exotic homotopy 3 spheres, there are homology 3 spheres with non-trivial fundamental group. And so the simplest one of those is the so-called Poincaré homology sphere. And somehow the Poincaré homology sphere really wants to be an exotic sphere. And they're not letting him into the club because he's not simply connected, but he's still trying really hard, and that's really somehow where the Z2 is coming from. So then that kind of fills in the story. And this is a slightly different thing, in that really there's an intermediate category between topological and smooth called the piecewise linear category. This is the whole story about putting piecewise linear structures on topological manifolds, and then everything else is how you get from PL to diff. Notice that this construction here works in the PL category as well, so you don't see these exotic spheres in the PL category. All right, so that's pretty much the whole story about smoothing theory then in high dimensions. Oh, I guess maybe one other thing I should mention is how do we see this difference between isotopy and diffeomorphism? Well, if we take, for example, S7 cross S7, then I can smooth this so that the first one is exotic and the second one is standard, or I could do it the other way around. And those two things are clearly diffeomorphic to each other using the homeomorphism that interchanges the two factors. But that homeomorphism is not isotopic to the identity. And in fact, these two smoothings will be distinguished by this uniqueness obstruction. So this whole theory really is classifying things up to isotopy, and the story up to diffeomorphism is a little bit more subtle. But having said that, for the rest of the talk, I'm going to concentrate on distinguishing things up to diffeomorphism rather than up to isotope. All right, and the one other observation we should make is that each, for n greater than or equal to 5, each compact n manifold has only finitely many smoothings up to isotopy. The point being that all these coefficient groups are finite, so we're always measuring uniqueness with finite things. And So for any compact manifold, you're only going to see all these groups will be finite. More generally, similarly, in more generality, if the homology of Xn is finitely generated, even if it's non-compact, then still you'll only get finitely many smoothings. So this theory is really trying to be finite in some fairly strong sense. So that now brings us to dimension 4. What's going on in dimension 4? Well, in dimension 4, again, the high dimensional machinery doesn't work. Up until the early 80s, almost nothing was known about any of this sort of stuff. And then in the early 80s, right about when I was a graduate student, actually, there were these two rather dramatic breakthroughs from rather different directions in mathematics. And those two things really revolutionized the field. The early 80s, there was Friedman's work, first of all. And what Friedman basically showed is that the high-dimensional theory works for topological four manifolds. So unlike in higher dimensions, the topological answer came before the smooth answer. And this took a lot of hard work with point set topology and stuff like that. But for topological four manifolds, the high-dimensional theory works, so let's say, as long as pi 1 is not too large. So if pi 1 is finite or abelian or has polynomial growth or whatever, then certainly what I've said actually works. So he got surgery theory and the H-Gabordism theorem running for simply connected manifolds, in fact, a much larger class of manifolds. And right away, we went from knowing almost nothing to having a complete classification of simply connected topological four manifolds, which, well, if the high-dimensional machinery runs and we can classify simply connected five and six manifolds, I guess it's natural to expect that. But the hard work was in getting the machinery running. And so I should say a little bit about this classification then. So simply connected closed, compact and boundaryless, that is, topological four manifolds are classified by two things. First of all, there's the Kirby-Siebenmann invariant in H upper 4 of X with Z2 coefficients. Well, that, well, I'm assuming, simply connected implies connected, so this is just going to be Z2, so it's either 0 or not 0. So that's sort of a small piece of of what classifies. And then there's this, what carries most of the information is the so-called intersection pairing that I'll call Q of the manifold X, which takes two-dimensional homology cross itself into the integers. And the way we can think about this is that we want to pair two homology classes, two-dimensional homology classes. Well, each of those turns out to be represented by an embedded surface. And so we can just look at how the surfaces intersect. We sort of put them in general position, which in the smooth world is easy, and Friedman ultimately showed in the end works also in the topological world. But just by transversality in the smooth world, you can arrange these things to intersect in finitely many points with sine, and then you just count with sine, and that's your answer. It turns out to only depend on the homology classes. So that's the intersection pairing, and this is a unimodular symmetric bilinear form over the integers. Unimodular just means the determinant is plus or minus 1.
In higher dimensions, is the data something like this too? Or
That's part of it, yeah. Whenever the dimension is divisible by 4, then you're going to have a symmetric pairing in the middle dimension. When it's congruent to 2 mod 4, you'll have a skew symmetric pairing, and then instead of getting things like signature, you'll get an ARF invariant. And so it's a the details get kind of different, but it's the same in spirit. Then in odd dimensions, you don't have a middle dimension, and so that's a different story yet. So it really somehow breaks up into three cases that all are related, but the details are different. So, all right. So now, yeah, but all these things somehow persist in some form in dimension 4, especially when the dimension is congruent to 0 mod 4. And, all right, so what do we get here? In fact, each such pairing is realized by, say, one or two homeomorphism types. There's a distinction between so-called even and odd pairings, and for even pairings, there's a unique homeomorphism type, and for odd pairings, there are exactly two, one of which is unsmoothable because its Kirby's Evenman obstruction is non-zero, and the other may or may not. High-dimensional theory predicts that it ought to be smoothable, but we'll come back to that. So this is basically the complete classification according to Friedman. And all right, so that's, let's then contrast that with Donaldson's work. And so Donaldson, I guess announced within a year of Friedman's work, pretty much contemporaneous with Friedman's work, Donaldson proved something very different, namely, the first thing he proved is that if a smooth closed, and he said simply connected, but ultimately it's not necessary, a smooth closed four-manifold has a definite intersection pairing. So I really should say oriented here if I'm not going to say simply connected. If it has a definite intersection pairing, then the pairing is diagonalizable. So the fact is there are a lot of definite intersection pairings, a lot of different definite unimodular symmetric forms over the integers, which are not diagonalizable over the integers, even though they are over the reals necessarily. And according to Friedman, all those are realized by one or two homeomorphism types of four manifolds. But then Donaldson says all those strange intersection pairings actually can't be realized by smooth manifolds. So the conclusion then is that a lot of the things Friedman wrote down here actually cannot admit smooth structures. And so the first punchline here is that a lot of these things Friedman wrote down with strange intersection pairings actually have a vanishing Kirby's Evenman obstruction. So high-dimensional theory predicts they ought to be smoothable, and yet Donaldson says they're not smoothable. So there's the first place where the two theories begin to diverge, that a lot of things that ought to be smoothable actually aren't. And, all right, so how did Donaldson do this? Well, unlike Friedman's purely topological techniques, Donaldson was actually working with gauge theory, PDEs, on these strange manifolds, and basically he took one of these hypothetical manifolds and played around with the so-called self-dual Legang-Mills equations, looked at the solution space, and concluded that it had impossible properties. There's a simplification due to Fintichel and Stern that works sometimes where the moduli space turns out to be a compact one-manifold with boundary, and the boundary is one point. And you can't have a compact one-manifold as boundary is one point, so there's your contradiction. So these things, in fact, don't exist. And it's by, of course, gauge theory, which is using in a very deep way the smooth structure of the manifold. So, all right. So what does that do for us? Well, it shows that the existence part of high-dimensional theory fails in dimension 4. And then there's the question about uniqueness. And it turned out that within a few years, Donaldson was using the same machinery to construct invariants of 4 manifolds. And Donaldson constructed examples of simply connected 4 manifolds with more than one smooth structure. And, well, to fast forward to the present day now, what it turns out that a typical smooth, simply connected, closed 4 manifold actually has infinitely many smoothings up to diffeomorphism. So there, for a typical homeomorphism type, you get infinitely many different 4 manifolds, all of which are homeomorphic to that one, but no two of them are diffeomorphic. So that's fairly typical behavior of these things. And so, on the one hand, high-dimensional theory predicts that for any compact manifold, we should only get finitely many smoothings, and here we've got infinitely many, countably infinitely, which for basic reasons is all we can hope for on compact manifolds. And on the other hand, what does high-dimensional theory predict? Well, the failure of uniqueness is H upper 3 with Z2 coefficients, and that vanishes for a simply connected 4 manifold. So in fact, these things should have only one smoothing according to high-dimensional theory, and yet they have infinitely many smoothings. So we see things breaking down more and more rather rapidly as far as the high-dimensional theory. Somehow what's happening is that topological manifolds look like high-dimensional manifolds and smooth manifolds don't, and so there's this clash between the two categories. Maybe you could think of it as being some kind of a phase transition between low and high-dimensional topology or something like that. So things are really complicated. But dimension 4 is very different from any other dimension because of all this stuff. So now that we have all this stuff sketched out, let's look at some things we can do with it. So we'll start out with a simple example of, let's look at the complex projective plane. That's a very simple example of a smooth, simply connected, closed 4 manifold. Compact and boundaryless, if you like. And so what is its intersection pairing? Well, CP2 has two homology just given by the integers. CP2 is a complex projective plane. Inside of it, we have a lot of projective lines, all of which are homotopic to each other. Any one of these projective lines gives the generator of this class. And any two lines intersect in a point, sort of basic geometry, so that says that the intersection pairing should be plus or minus 1, and in fact it's plus 1 because this is complex, and somehow complex transverse intersections are always positive. So the intersection pairing of, well, let me just write down the matrix. With respect to the standard basis for CP2, the matrix is just 1. Q of CP2, let's say. On the other hand, if I reverse orientation here with the caveat that's not complex conjugation, it's orientation reversal, then in fact what we get is negative 1. Right? Flipping the sign of the generator doesn't change the square, but flipping the ambient orientation does change it. So we have two different pairings here, and we could get a typical diagonal pairing just by taking, if I take the connected sum of k CP2s and L CP2s with reversed orientation, then the intersection pairing of that is going to be given by a matrix with K1s down the diagonal and L negative ones. So there's a typical example of a diagonalizable pairing. In fact, it's diagonal with respect to the sort of obvious basis of all the projective lines inside of there. And according to Friedman, in fact, according to Friedman and Donaldson together, any smooth, simply connected 4 manifold with an odd intersection pairing is actually homeomorphic to this thing. So there's a nice, simple example. So, all right, what can we do with this example? Now, the next thing I want to observe is that, well, let's look specifically when k is 1 and l is 9. Then we're going to get a 1 and we're going to get 9 minus 1s down the diagonal. And turns out that pairing is isomorphic to 1 and then a non-standard negative definite pairing here. So that's basically just algebra. There's a classification of the indefinite pairings that says that the indefinite odd pairings are all diagonalizable. So all you need to know is that a non-standard negative definite pairing of rank 9 exists, and then in fact this thing is odd and indefinite, and so it's isomorphic to that. So we know that there's an algebraic isomorphism between these two things. And so now what I want to do is write that same manifold in a very different looking way. What I'm going to do is take Friedman's non-standard negative definite manifold, the one with this particular pairing here, and I'm going to connect and sum it with CP2, which gives me that piece of it. And now this is a topological manifold, which, according to Friedman's classification, is homeomorphic to CP2 connected sum with 9 CP2 bars. Well, this thing in particular is smooth. So the thing I've written here as a connected sum admits a smooth structure, but it's not going to be compatible with this connected sum, obviously, because this thing on the left is not a smoothable manifold. So now what we want to do is, let's just indicate, we've just done in the topological world, we've done a connected sum here. So this is topologically S3 cross R, connecting up these two pieces. But of course, smoothly, it's got some really screwy smooth structure on it. And the next observation I want to make is that according to Friedman, or really according to the foundational work of Kasson preceding Friedman's, this whole bunch of stuff can actually be smoothly embedded into an honest CP2. So let me draw that same picture. This whole bunch of stuff to the right of the blue lives over here somewhere. So all this red stuff here is going to come out over here. And so now this is a diffeomorphism of an open set, open subset of this manifold into CP2. Well, what I actually want to look at here is this piece of it. I'm going to call it R. And what do we notice about this piece? Well, first of all, I've split CP2 as a connected sum of CP2 and something else. So by Friedman's classification, that something else is just a four-sphere. So R is a four-sphere minus a point. This open piece now it's homeomorphic to a sphere minus a point, which is just R4. But now what I want to observe is that it's not diffeomorphic to R4. Why is that? Well, if it were diffeomorphic to R4, this blue compact set here would sit inside of some smooth ball, so I would have a nice smooth three-sphere here. But then that smooth three-sphere would live over here, and then I could just cut along it and glue in a smooth ball, and I'd have a contradiction to Donaldson's theorem. So putting together these two big theories, we get an exotic R4. It's homeomorphic to R4, but not diffeomorphic to R4. The idea for this construction actually goes back to Kasson's work in the 70s, but he couldn't get the punchline because neither Friedman nor Donaldson had done their stuff yet. But in some sense, this is Kasson's construction. And it really amazed topologists when it came out, because you compare with smoothing theory in other dimensions. Well, in dimensions 3 and below, everything's trivial according to Moise. In higher dimensions, Well, Rn has no topology, so there's no obstructions, and so there's a unique smooth structure up to isotopy, and yet here we have this exotic smooth structure on R4. So this was a really amazing thing when it came out. And that may be the, well, this whole stuff about exotic R4s is probably the best demonstration of the catastrophic failure of high-dimensional smoothing theory in dimension 4. I'll push this even farther in a few moments. But one thing I want to observe is that that we can play other games with this. Actually, one of the first things, the original argument didn't look like this. There was an S2 cross 2, S2 cross S2 in place of CP2, which was what you get if you just use high-dimensional surgery theory in sort of the obvious way, as all the topologists at the time were trained to do. And I came along as a naive graduate student, and I thought, well, why not use CP2? That's just as good as S2 cross S2. And it works just as well, but in fact, it even gives us more stuff, because one thing we notice is that R doesn't smoothly embed in any negative definite manifold. Because if it did, well, if we had this negative definite manifold and we had our copy of R here, then what we could do is cut along this neck here, and we could diffeomorphically take this stuff and glue it onto the end of this neck in place of CP2, and that would change the manifold to something that's still negative definite and non-standard. So this is what I've subsequently called a large exotic R4, meaning it doesn't embed into S4, and in fact it has compact subsets that don't embed into S4. But more than that, we see it doesn't embed into anything negative definite at all, whereas it does embed inside of CP2 by construction, which is positive definite. So that says that R has no orientation reversing self-diffeomorphism, and I can play yet another game. I can take R and R with its reverse orientation, and we could sort of overlap them a little, get a new exotic R4, and that one doesn't embed in either of these things, and so it has to be different from, so now up to orientation preserving diffeomorphism, there are at least four smooth structures on R4. So after that, shortly after I got my PhD, I kept pushing this stuff harder and eventually showed there were infinitely many smoothings on R4. But then the real punchline somehow was that shortly after that, we discovered that there were uncountably many. And, well, maybe I shouldn't say we have played a fairly small role in that observation, in that part. Basically, what happened is that Friedman had the idea. He attributed the antecedents of it to Kirby in high dimensions. And he told me about it, and I told Taubes about it. And Taubes wrote a 200-page paper to justify the gauge theory, and after that, it was all done. So it was very easy. So all you need is Taubes to do all the work for you, and then it's very easy. So it really should be attributed primarily to Taubes, I guess. But the theorem then is that there exist uncountably exotic R4s. And we can see that without a whole lot of trouble at this point. Let me draw this exotic R4 R end on, so then we see something that looks kind of like this. Here's our exotic R4 with this funny collar out near infinity. And what we notice is that R is topologically just R4. So if I forget about the smooth structure, then I can think of all the balls of all real radii, all the open balls of all sufficiently large real radii inside of here. And I'm just going to take the radius large enough so that this blue compact set is inside of all these things. And what I claim now is that no two of these are diffeomorphic to each other. They all admit smooth structures as open subsets of R. They're all obviously homeomorphic to R4, and I claim that no two of them are diffeomorphic. And the reason is that, so we've got this family RT. Well, the reason no two of these are diffeomorphic is, suppose two of them were diffeomorphic. So I have one of them out here and another one down here that are diffeomorphic to each other. Well, I could take some little collar around this one like this, and that would be diffeomorphic to some little collar around this one. So now I have these two disjoint collars inside here, and I have this region in between, which is homeomorphic to S3 cross R. So now what I can do is observe that that collar exists over here, and then we can cut out this CP2, and we can glue in one of these new collars, and glue in another one, and glue in another one, go on out to infinity, and then we get a smooth structure that has a certain periodicity to itself, and that there's a translation that sends it sort of one notch out to infinity. And what Taubes did with his 200-page paper is to show that that is a suitable condition at infinity that allows Donaldson's work to go through. And so in the end, this manifold contradicts an n-periodic analog of Donaldson's theorem. So we have this indirect argument that gives us infinitely many, uncountably many exotic R4s with the cardinality of the continuum. And well, just to play this